or afraid. Dear brothers and sisters, the Holy Spirit is with you.
I'm Kathleen McCarthy, and you're listening to What the World Needs Now, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. I invite you to join me in this hour of God's healing power. Call and join us in conversation and prayer. Remember, what the world needs now is God, and God is love.
And good evening and welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is Ken Johnston, your host for the next hour, and I'll be joined in a moment by Mr. Michael Heinlein, and we'll be talking about some causes for canonization that he brought to our attention back in November. But before we go to Michael, I just want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners for your ongoing support of us here at In His Sign Radio Network and our ability to continue to broadcast shows like today's. And we do so every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. It's been a blessing in all of our lives here at In His Sign to be able to do 2 hours a day for, I guess, almost a year now. March, I guess it'll be a year. And also a reminder that on April 30th, we'll be celebrating our annual Wake Up America dinner out at the Malvern Retreat House. Join Kathleen and a special guest will be there. The cost is $45 per person or $320 for a table of eight. You can give Maureen a call here at In His Sign, 610-527-2906. That's 610-527-2906. And get your reservations in. It'd be wonderful to fill the dining room there at St. Joseph's in the Hills Retreat House in Malvern. And again, that's April 30th. Normally, I've actually had a few people ask me because we normally had it in January. And I think we've been blessed to be able to move it out to April. It's spreads it out from our golf outing that we have in October, and also the weather should be a little bit better. A few years there, we had snow and ice and those types of things that precluded people from getting there. Hopefully with a date at the end of April, we won't have to worry about that this year. So again, that's April 30th, Malvern Retreat House. Give us a call and make your reservations. So I'm always pleased to have this hour show and on Wednesday evenings and be able to talk to all different folks in the Catholic world about what's going on currently in the Catholic Church. And that's why today we're going to have Michael Heinlein from our Sunday Visitor. He's a regular contributor to our Sunday Visitor, a number of articles that you can get online. And he wrote an article back in November about the cause for canonizations that have been introduced for four new Americans. And we'll be talking about that today. So it's my pleasure to welcome to the show Michael Heinlein. Hello, Michael.
Yes, hello. Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thanks for being with us. We appreciate it. And
very honored.
And like I say, it's always great to keep up with what's going on in the church. And we just finished a show a couple of minutes ago here at In His Sign called Saints and Sinners, and each week we talk about the saints that our Catholic Church holds up for us as examples to imitate in our growth in holiness. And what got us interested in today's topic was an article that you wrote back in November about these these new possible saints, right? Their causes have been introduced. And before we right. go, before we go to them specifically, maybe for some people, I know because of my experience and being involved with the cause for canonization for Venerable Matt Talbot, that sometimes it can be a long process, and people often don't understand everything that goes on. And what I didn't know as far as Matt Talbot's cause is how that cause actually gets introduced. And I thought maybe before we go to the four individuals, if you could just, highlight for us, you know, how does one actually start the cause for someone's canonization?
Sure. Well, obviously, with all sainthood causes, the idea is that we have a holy man or a woman in front of us who had a reputation for holiness when they were alive. And if that reputation survived their death and lasted the decades and perhaps centuries after their death, then usually that becomes noticed by several people in the church. And so a sainthood cause would be introduced by either that person's religious order or the diocese where that person lived or worked, and that process would initiate that way. The church does have a requirement since the pontificate of Pope St. John Paul II that there's a 5-year waiting period after someone's death, which doesn't seem to be all that long, but in some cases that's proven to be too long. For Mother Teresa and John Paul II as well, those that requirement was waived by John Paul for Mother Teresa and then Pope Benedict for John Paul II himself.
Mm. Very good. So it the fall assembly then of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, why they were gathered there is where the causes would be asked to be officially started or advanced?
Yeah, so it would have been initiated within the diocese for each of the four newer, the most recent causes that were brought up at the USCCB. They did start at the diocesan level first. So obviously their reputation for holiness was known by the people and the bishop of their diocese, current bishop of their diocese. And so people started talking about this, and there has to be some evidence that this is someone who lived a holy life that is exemplary in heroic virtue, someone who should be emulated by others for their faith and for their living out of the gospel. And then the bishop makes a decision, is this something we want to pursue as a diocese, as a local church? And so what happened in November is that four bishops brought forward the names of various candidates that they consider worthy of canonization from their own diocese. And part of the process requires them to bring that candidate before the body of American bishops. And so that meeting was the annual plenary session of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the bishops nominated these four particular figures. Two of them were priests, one of them was a former slave, and one was a nun. And the bishops, as a body, approved these four people to move forward in the canonization process. Before they would have voted, each bishop in the United States would have received a dossier, so to speak, a biography and other material that each diocesan bishop would have sent out. And that would have been reviewed by every bishop before they made their vote. And then at the meeting itself, the four bishops came forward before their brother bishops and put forth the vote.
Very good. And so the assumption would be then they go back to their diocese, they compile all that information, and then it would go to the Holy See in Rome, where a postulator would be named to advance the cause for the church in general. And then a vice postulator, I would assume, in the diocese would remain, who would continue to gather information, promote the cause for the canonization of that individual, and really spread the word about their heroic virtue and why they should be a saint.
Yes, so. There's a lot of work that goes into a canonization cause at the grassroots level. The diocese would, in fact, have a local vice postulator. And the postulator could be local, although, given the way the process works, usually the postulator is in Rome.
Right.
And that postulator's job is to collect all of the evidence that's needed to prove that this person lived a holy life, and at the time of their death, they are now in heaven. Hmm. There are two commissions that are set up at the local level initially, both a theological commission and a historical commission, and they have a very serious task of collecting everything they can about this person. And then, not to mention all of that, they also have the task of investigating any miracles that would be reported that are contributed or on the part of the individual candidate. So, obviously, we believe if someone is in heaven, they are close friends of God, and therefore they intercede with God for our requests. And so the church does require a miracle for beatification and a miracle for canonization. There's one loophole to that, I suppose, in that if someone died a martyr's death, then they do not need a miracle for beatification. However, there's a separate investigatory process there to prove whether or not that person died a martyr, because that is a very technical term according to the church's tradition.
Sure. Makes sense to me. And like I said, I've watched it the process a little bit with Venerable Matt Talbot, someone whose cause I'm involved with. And mm-hmm. working with the vice postulator in Dublin, Father Brian Lawless, and in that process, we thought we had a miracle about a year or two ago with a baby that was born in the Midwest, and we thought that this was going to be the miracle that we'd get him moved from being venerable to blessed. And unfortunately, like you said, the church is very scrupulous when it comes to these causes for canonization, and when all the medical records were sent to Rome and the postulator reviewed it, came back, and he was not agreeing that it was a miracle. So for a lot of us, it was a letdown, and back to the drawing board. But this is a situation, I think, at least with Matt Talbot, where I think there's been hundreds, if not thousands, of miracles that can be attributed to him. But they're all the psychological variety. So there's not people that had an alcohol problem or a drug problem, and through Matt's intercession, have gotten into recovery, and many have died, sober or clean from drugs, and a lot of us believe it's a direct result of Matt Talbot's intercession. But because that's one of those things that's almost impossible to prove, because there's no physical evidence of it, mm-hmm. that it's difficult to get folks to approve that type of miracle. But back to the four that you wrote about in November, as you mentioned, it was two priests, a former slave and an immigrant nun, and mm-hmm. It looks like they were all late 19th century, early 20th century folks when these people were here. And again, they're all Americans here in the United States. And maybe we can go through them in the order that you wrote about them, Michael. The first being a Julia Greeley, who interesting character, and I was happy to see that, like myself, was a Third Order Franciscan. And
yes, she had a great love for Franciscan life, but also the Sacred Heart. She was very dedicated to the Sacred Heart. And that's part of her story as well. She was born into slavery, and she was in Missouri actually near Mark Twain's hometown of Hannibal. And she got connected with a family, kind of working in their house after she earned her freedom after Abraham Lincoln's 1863 Emancipation Proclamation. And lo and behold, the father of this family was eventually named to be the territorial governor of Colorado before it was a state. And so she traveled out there with them. And it seemed to be rather providential, really, that she was brought to Colorado because that's where she was introduced to the Catholic faith and really fell in love with it. She converted, and she belonged to a parish there dedicated to the Sacred Heart, and that's how she got to know that devotion. And she really kind of threw herself into Catholic life by, again, joining the Third Order Franciscans, going to daily Mass, very active in the prayer and spiritual life. She was great in fasting, and she was also very extraordinarily so dedicated to the poor. And that was really her lasting legacy, was how she treated the poor in Denver.
Very good. And it says that there was nearly 1,000 mourners at her funeral, and I'm thinking that that when she left Hannibal, Missouri, and went to Colorado, it wasn't like a whole lot of friends and family were coming with her, right? She was going with the people that she had had worked for. So over the course of her life, obviously she was recognized why she was living for that many people to show up for a funeral. And again, it's, I don't think Colorado, it's not a state yet. It's not built up like it is today in the late 19th century. So for 1,000 people to show up at her funeral means that even as, you know, while she was alive, people recognized the work that she was doing and her holiness.
Absolutely. And presumably the accounts at the time that were in the newspaper, many of the people who were there at her funeral were people whose lives she had touched in one way or another. She had a great apostolate to bring people to the devotion to the Sacred Heart, and she would constantly be distributing images of the Sacred Heart or telling people to pray the litany or make the consecration. One of the groups she was very keen on evangelizing in that way were firemen. So I think she had a strong relationship with the firemen in Denver at the time. And then also, as I mentioned, the poor, she would work all sorts of odd jobs, cooking, cleaning, and so on, to try to earn money. And she wasn't so concerned about the money for herself, but she would use that to buy much-needed supplies for the poor, clothing, food, so on. And I guess she was kind of almost comically known as having this little red wagon that she would load all this stuff on and go around through Denver with her floppy hat that was kind of her signature trademark, going around distributing these goods to people and praying with them. And at times she would even herself take to begging for them so that she could get more things for them. She really lived for others. She had a heart full of love, and I suppose that's why she was so connected to the Sacred Heart, because she really emulated Christ's overflowing heart of love and mercy in really everything she did.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. So that may be a good lead-in then to Monsignor Bernard Quinn. And Monsignor Bernard Quinn began a parish for African Americans in Brooklyn in 1921, and maybe a little bit of a link to Julia, that he dedicated, the parish there was dedicated to the missionary St. Peter Claver, who served and defended African slaves in Colombia. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about Monsignor Quinn.
Sure. Monsignor Quinn was a native of New Jersey, but at the time when he was in the seminary, when he was wanting to go into the seminary, his diocese said that there were too many that wanted to be ordained. If only we had that problem today.
Exactly.
But anyway, he got connected with the Bishop of Brooklyn, New York, and they accepted him into the seminary. He was a chaplain in the military during World War One, and he served in France. And actually, it was in France that he developed a great love and spiritual relationship with Saint Therese of Lisieux, the little flower. Mm. In fact, reports, historical evidence shows that he was the first priest to have said Mass in the home where Saint Therese was born, in Alençon, France, in the home of her parents, who are now saints, Saints Louis and Zélie Martin.
Sure.
And so anyway, when he came back to the United States, he... I'm sorry?
No, we're fine. Go.
When he came back to the United States, he was assigned to a parish that had been accepting a lot of African-American parishioners. And I say accepting because there were a lot of parishes at that time in history that were still segregated. And that went up long until the 1960s in some places. But this was in the early 1920s. And he really had a heart of love for the minorities, and he wanted to make sure that the church was giving all the resources that we could to the minority communities. And so he established this black parish, a black Catholic parish, in the Diocese of Brooklyn. And he really became so beloved among that community, as was St. Catherine Drexel at the time from Philadelphia, right, who had done so much for Native Americans and black Catholics as well. He became friends with her. He knew her very well and received her assistance in growing his community. And he ended up dying in 1940, and again, thousands of people at his funeral, people from all over who knew him and who were touched by him and his ministry and experienced the love of Christ in his work.
Very good. Definitely sounds like a man to be emulated, and maybe one that we pray to for vocations. Like you said, to be turned down in Newark because there were too many vocations and have to enlist up in Brooklyn. Like you said, it'd be a wonderful problem to have that today.
Yes, and that's sadly the story with so many priests in the old days that you can hear, but it's really inspiring to see their faith that they knew what God was calling them to, and they didn't give up.
Yeah, very good. Next on the list, Michael, is Sister Blandina. Is it Segal?
Segale. Yeah.
And
she came from Italy. Her parents emigrated and brought their children here. She was 4 years old at the time, and she wanted to enter religious life. They had settled in Cincinnati, Ohio. And so she joined the Sisters of Charity there in Cincinnati when she was rather young. She was only 16. And she worked in various schools and so on in Ohio. But her life kind of took a big turn in the early 1870s when she was sent out to the Wild West. And she ended up out in Colorado, also like Julia Greeley that we were talking about earlier. And in Colorado, she was obviously surrounded by a lot of vigilante justice, and it was a wild, lawless place. And actually, it was out there that she encountered Billy the Kid, who came to the town she was missioned at. And she actually stopped Billy the Kid from killing four people. And it's kind of a legendary story. And in the 1960s, there was a TV show that even kind of dramatized that story a little bit. Hmm. But eventually, she made her way to New Mexico. Actually, there's a book of her journals that's been published within the last couple years. It's been republished. And it talks about all these different experiences that she had out in the Wild West. It's called At the End of the Santa Fe Trail. And anyway, she was there for many years and eventually made her way back to Ohio in Cincinnati, where she worked with her sister, who was a nun of the same community, and they started a center for Italian immigrants in Cincinnati. But it was the Archdiocese of Santa Fe, New Mexico, that initiated her sainthood clause because of the legacy that she left there, especially founding a hospital and assisting the poor and the immigrants there as well.
Yeah, when I had read the article, I found it interesting, both the first visit or first encounter with Billy the Kid when he had come to scout poor doctors, and then apparently she caught up with him again and visited him in jail.
Yeah, well, I guess he was making his way all around the Wild West, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was along the Santa Fe Trail, which is a very popular route. And so, yeah, she had an encounter with him later on after she had moved down. And even when that encounter happened, she visited him in jail, the story goes.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's Sister Blandina Segali. Mm-hmm. And the fourth one on your list, Michael, was Father Patrick Ryan. I got a good friend, Pat Ryan. I'm hoping he's listening. But Father Patrick Ryan was a priest in Tennessee, it looks like.
Yes, he was in Chattanooga, which at the time the whole state of Tennessee was the Diocese of Nashville. But now it's in the Diocese of Knoxville, which was erected as a diocese in the 1980s. And so they've taken up the cause. He died in 1877 at the age of 33, and he died so young because he caught yellow fever. There was an epidemic going through that region at the time. He could have gotten out. People had kind of told him, you know, Father, you better leave, but he refused to do so. He stayed in town, and he cared for all the victims of the yellow fever, went out and anointed them, and you know, spread the love of Christ to them in their moments of need. And so that I read, in fact, that the Diocese of Knoxville is calling him a martyr of charity because his life was really sacrificed for the good of others, and for their spiritual well-being. So his service is certainly something that's been well remembered in Chattanooga.
Very good. Again, the number's here, 610-527-2906. It's 610-527-2906 or 888-34-FAITH. That's 888-343-2484. Michael, we're at the bottom of the hour. We're just going to take a short break. We'll be back in a minute.
Sounds great.
All right.
This is Pat Wally. I have been a faithful listener of In His Sign for almost 9 years, so it is with much gratitude and appreciation in my heart that I reflect on how my life has been blessed through this beautiful anointed ministry. I personally have been the recipient of many answered prayers and healings, not only for myself, but also family and friends. You have been called, Kathleen, to speak all over the world. And wherever God sends you, the Holy Spirit uses you in amazing ways to touch the hearts and lives of God's hurting people through your extraordinary gift of healing. God bless you, Kathleen.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We are blessed to have had this Catholic radio apostolate for almost 40 years now. Thanks be to God for your partnership. Without you, this radio voice would be silenced. We have a monthly Mass offered for you, our loyal family of listeners. It's our way of saying thank you for underpinning our apostolate with your many prayers and financial support. This is your radio ministry, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to evangelize and to catechize for a time such as this. We know the Lord will bless you abundantly. He can never be outdone in generosity. If this ministry has touched your heart, help us to touch other hearts by supporting us with your prayers and financial support. Call us at 610-527-2906 or visit our website at inhissign.com.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. Again, this is Ken Johnston, your host for the next 30 minutes. We're halfway through our show today. And again, I want to praise and thank God for all of your prayers and ongoing financial support that allow us to bring you shows like today's. Reminder that on April the 30th will be our Wake Up America dinner, our one of two fundraisers we have each year. And you can come out to St. Joseph's in the Hills Retreat House in Malvern, Pennsylvania. Come by yourself or maybe grab seven friends and get a table of eight and come on out and join us. The cost will be $35 per person or $320 for a table of eight. And you can make your reservations by calling Maureen here at In His Sign. The numbers, again, 610-527-2906. That's 610-527-2906. Our guest today is Michael Heinlein, a regular contributor at our Sunday Visitor. It's has a large online presence now. I think you still have paper editions, right, Michael?
Oh yeah, certainly.
Yeah. And
paper is the only National Catholic News Weekly, and it's certainly available in parishes, and you can subscribe online, and we also are available online as well.
Right, and the website would be osv.com, real simple to remember, osv.com, and you can see all of Michael's works out there. And the reason we had him on today was to talk about the four causes for canonization that have been opened for new American saints, and to give us an understanding of how the process works, and just to bring them to our attention, perhaps any one of the four would be ones that would touch your heart as far as the things that they had done. You know, the devotion to the Sacred Heart of Julia Greeley or what have you. And the beauty of the Internet, a lot of it can be not so good. But one of the beauties of the Internet today is that on any of these four, I'm sure you can find not only Michael's article, but much other information about them. So, Michael, I don't want to keep you any longer than we have to, but I know that you're a regular contributor there at our Sunday Visitor. Are there is any other topics that you might want to bring to our attention today?
Well, I have been recently putting together something that's forthcoming, and it should be out in our Sunday Visitor in the next couple of weeks, a rather lengthy piece on Black Catholics in the United States in preparation for Black History Month. And so obviously when the United States and other countries like Canada and the UK celebrate Black History Month, there tends to be a focus on those who are involved in the civic life of the country, especially. And so oftentimes there tends to be a neglect of the great Catholic witness of the black community in the United States. And so I'm trying to draw together some profiles of various figures from the Black Catholic community who have made a significant impact in the church, but also in society in the United States.
Yeah. I know here in Philadelphia, obviously, in I would imagine that a lot of that activity would take place in some of our larger cities, and a number of parishes, both in Center City here in Philadelphia and, you know, even out in the suburbs. And I know in my own parish that there's very few, but more and more as they... more folks move out of the city and come out to the suburbs, as well as the number of converts to the Catholic faith, much like Julia Greeley. And
And along with Julia Greeley, there are actually four others from the Black Catholic community who are currently in the process for canonization as well. So I hope to highlight their stories in this upcoming piece and bring people to recognize the holiness that is part of the Catholic Church in the United States, and how that holiness knows no bounds in terms of ethnicity and so on.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, because I think a lot of times we get pigeonholed by people outside the church that maybe we are only for whites and only for European white. And with all the immigration that's taken place here in the United States, I know in this area, and especially where I have my full-time employment, there's a large Filipino community, and I a lot of times they tend to be on the coast. So I've large Filipino communities on the East Coast and West Coast. I know my son went to Mass a couple Sundays ago. He works at a local diner, and every once in a while he tries to catch a 5 o'clock Mass on Sunday evening if he can't get there in the morning. And he actually had a second commitment for Sunday night and was trying to squeeze in Mass somewhere and came across an Urdu Mass, the Pakistani language, and went there. So so many of these groups now that are in our area. I can speak only for Philadelphia, where we have Spanish Masses and the Urdu and Indian and all the different nationalities that as they continue to come to America. And in one way, I think it's awesome that as a result of Vatican II that we can have Mass in our native languages. And but in other ways, sometimes I long for that Latin Mass where regardless of who we are and where we've come from, that we would have that in common. And even when my son, who's 18, when he came home from the Urdu Mass, even the readings, the homily, everything was in Urdu. But yet, because they follow the same pattern of the Mass, he knew exactly where they were and what they were doing throughout, which is, I think, something that we as Catholics have and can appreciate, that perhaps those in non-Catholic Christian faith, where they, no matter where we go in the world on any given Sunday, especially as Roman Catholics, we can celebrate the Mass that's almost identical, and know where we are in the Mass as it proceeds. So,
yes, that's part of the beauty of the faith. The Catholic faith, Catholic meaning universal. So,
right.
The Church is alive and active in almost every country in the world, and so. Right. America being as it is, in the beacon in the West, people are coming from all sorts of places, and that's really the story of the Black Catholic community. They came here, many of them, against their own desire and their own will, but the faith is what kept them going, and so that's why I wanted to try to tell a little bit of their story.
And that would be a faith that I would imagine did not come with them. It would have been something that they would have gotten as a result of coming to the United States? They would not?
The particular history of the Black Catholics in the United States, most of them would have probably been introduced to the Catholic faith here. However, that's not always the case.
Okay.
Some of them would have had that faith when they were brought over as slaves. The four particular candidates for sainthood, in addition to Julia Greeley, they were all kind of products of conversion here. All of them had roots to slavery in one way or another, and they all were really kind of brought up in that environment of racial prejudice. But nonetheless, it was the Catholic faith that kind of helped them get through that and helped them transform all the hate and the bitterness of their experience into something that was very life-giving and filled with love and virtue.
And I'm sure when we get to read that article when it comes out in February, that what I find most interesting with those types of stories, Michael, is that as a cradle Catholic, I think a lot of us take these things for granted, that, you know, having come up in the faith, for some of us, it may just be, you know, the way we lived is the way we were brought up. Maybe we, you know, went to 8 or 12 years of Catholic school, and we're almost part of a Catholic culture, if you will, as opposed to a Catholic faith. And I can only speak from my own experience, you know, having brought up as a cradle Catholic and really letting go of all that for a number of years. Before I came back to the faith on my hands and knees, literally needing all the help I could get, and finding it here in the church, and then come to realize that all this was available to me all along, and it made me appreciate it even more. And that's why you know, shows like Marcus Grody's Coming Home Network and these other things that we're able to see and read about now, of people that convert to the Catholic faith and the reasons that they convert. And like I said, many of them I think we as cradle Catholics may take for granted. So the more of these stories we see, the more of the witnesses that that they bring to us is, I think, just a good thing. And I think it reaffirms for a lot of us, you know, what we've had all along, and hopefully brings us to a point where we appreciate it all the more. And what we like to share about, especially here at In His Sign, is the evangelization piece, that once we're, as individuals, we're, you know, committed to our Catholic faith and understand what God's calling us to, that we can then invite others. So the four that or the four that you'll write about, and Julia Greeley, it sounds like it would be through an invitation somehow or other that they... whether it was a direct invitation to come to Catholic Church, or a situation where they saw the examples of those that were around them that were Catholic and wanted to be a part of, you know, eventually came to the church. And apparently,
well, it's interesting because out of the five Black Catholics that are candidates for sainthood now in the United States, Julia Greeley is the only convert. The other four were actually all cradle Catholics, as it were.
How about that?
There's one in particular whose cause recently made some news about a month ago. His name's Father Augustus Tolton. I don't know if you or your listeners are familiar with him at all, but Father Augustus Tolton was the son of slaves. He grew up the first few years of his life as a slave himself in Missouri, and his dad went and broke through the system and got away to fight for the Union in the Civil War, and he was eventually he eventually died of an illness due to the war. The family never saw him again, but the mother and her children fled for their freedom. They crossed, in a very heroic story, they crossed the Mississippi on a boat with only one oar. It was the middle of the night, and bounty hunters were shooting at them, and they made it across to Illinois, which was free land. But they had known the faith from their slave owners, and that's how they were introduced to Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And Augustus was baptized as a baby. When he got to Illinois, he had trouble getting into the Catholic school because of the color of his skin. His mother wanted him to go. Eventually, the pastor there in Quincy, Illinois, just mandated that he be allowed into the school. And eventually he went to Quincy College there in that same town, and he wanted to become a priest, and he was under the tutelage of Franciscans. And so they helped him write to various seminaries in the United States, and none of them would take him because of the color of his skin. So they arranged for him to go to Rome, and the Pontifical Urban University, which was set up in Rome for missionaries, especially from Africa, to study for the priesthood. And so he went there, and his intention was to go to Africa as a missionary himself. Hmm. But the funny story is that the cardinal, the Italian cardinal who ordained him in Rome, said, you come from America, which regards itself as a so-called enlightened country. But let us see if that's really true, because they've never seen a black priest, but they will see one now. And they sent him back to the United States, which was not what he was planning for. And he went back to his hometown of Quincy and was just completely mistreated by the people, including the priests at the other parishes in town. He had a very sad life. But eventually, the Archbishop of Chicago at the time, this is in the late 1880s, early 1890s, Archbishop Patrick Feehan, he invited Father Tolton to Chicago to minister to black Catholics there, who had been settled in Chicago after the Civil War. And it was there that he died when he was in his 40s. He dropped dead of a stroke on the street on a hot July day as he was getting off the train from a retreat. And he just had a very heroic life where he never took the hatred and put it back in someone's face. He transformed it and turned it into love and service. And when people would tell him no, he never took an answer. He just kept persevering because he knew that God was calling him to greatness and holiness. The reason he was in the news recently was last month. His body was exhumed. He was brought back to Quincy, Illinois, to be buried when he died in 1897. And anyway, his body was exhumed, and they found some of his bones and so on and so forth. And so that canonization clause proceeds. There are two miracles currently being investigated for his cause in Rome. And it hasn't been all that long since it opened. The cause was opened in 2010 by the late Francis Cardinal George of Chicago. So Father Tolton is really just an amazing and inspiring figure that I hope Catholics all throughout the United States can come to know and come to be inspired by.
Very good. And with your help in the article that will come out in our Sunday Visitor, I'm sure we will be. We actually have a caller on the line. Hello, John. I'm sorry to keep you waiting. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask Mr. Heinlein about the process. Now, I understand there are 6 points. The first would be the opening of the cause. Then there is a declaration of heroic virtue. Then comes servant of God. After that is venerable. And then the final two are blessed, and then canonization. And for the final two, there's a miracle required. My question is, what is necessary for the declaration or the title servant of God, and what steps are necessary for the title of venerable? Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call.
To be declared servant of God usually comes fairly early on in the process, once the diocese officially opens the cause of canonization and Rome approves that action. And then after they're declared servant of God, then they go through the entire process to investigate this person's life of heroic virtue, to investigate their story. In many cases, every bit of writing has to be examined for these saints, and so in many cases it takes a long time, like for people like Fulton Sheen. He wrote, over 100 books, and so they all needed to be read and thoroughly investigated by theological experts. And when all of that work is done, they compose an official biography, which is called a positio, and that is worked with the Congregation for Saints in Rome. That's a process that they help write the positio, and they therefore prove that this person lived a life of heroic virtue. And then, at that point, the Pope approves that, hopefully, and then the person is declared venerable. So, once you make it to venerable, it's a very hopeful sign that the cause will proceed. Usually, in that time frame, miracles are coming in or being reported, and simultaneously, they are being investigated and sent off to Rome. But after someone is declared venerable, then they really take a serious step at looking at those miracles. And then once one is approved, then comes the papal approval in conjunction with the cardinals at a consistory in Rome to name that person blessed. So the real hurdle in the whole process is getting the declaration of venerable. But that's no guarantee by any means that the cause is going to proceed with any kind of haste.
Yeah, thank you for the explanation, Michael. I'm sorry to have disconnected you. We're getting a lot of feedback. I think your radio may have been on. So if you have a follow-up question, please call back. And for all of our callers, when you call, it helps if you turn the radio off in the background. Otherwise, we get a lot of feedback here. And I can speak to the last point that you were making, Michael, about, you know, once you get the venerable, it means you're going to move on. And one of the ones that, as I mentioned before, this Venerable Matt Talbot, we've been working on his cause for quite a while now, and it just can't come up with those miracles. So are there, I guess there's quite a few that would get the venerable and maybe never get there?
There are some. And in many cases, they kind of get stuck, so to speak. But
yeah.
There have been some cases in recent history, I think maybe five or six times, I'm not sure on the number, but several times within the pontificate of Pope Francis, where the Pope does have the power to canonize without this process that we're talking about. It's called equivalent canonization.
Okay.
And so he can kind of sidestep that process and not wait for a miracle. If he really believes that this person, you know, is very venerated in the church and renowned for their holiness universally. And he's done that in a couple cases, as I say, but so did Pope Benedict and John Paul II as well.
Yeah, well, I know with Matt Talbot, we're kind of hoping that with the World Meeting of Families being in Dublin in 2018, that'll be the time, that it'd be the ideal time, really, to have his canonization. But
yes, that would be great timing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and our caller did call back, and I think they have a follow-up question. Hello?
Yes, but the declaration of heroic virtue would entitle the person to be known as servant of God, and then the next step would be venerable. But that's still my question.
The declaration of heroic virtue doesn't come until after the positio is finished.
Venerable, not every servant.
And that doesn't come until
been granted a title.
It could be several years. I was just speaking about Father Augustus Tolton. He had the title of servant of God early on in life, or early on in the canonization process, rather. And the positio is still being formulated in Rome. He's not had the official declaration of heroic virtue, and he doesn't have the title of venerable yet. But that hopefully will come about, maybe in a year or two.
Does that answer your question, John?
Oh yeah, thank you very much. Now, I'll just conclude with this. Father Solanus Casey, is he about to be declared blessed? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
He has been declared venerable. I know about him because he lived in Huntington, Indiana, where our Sunday visitor is located, for quite a while. And his room, his bedroom, is preserved in what used to be the Franciscan Capuchin Friary there. He was declared venerable, I believe, close to 20 years ago. And I'm sure that miracles have been investigated. I don't know on the exact status of the cause, but I know that there has been nothing newsworthy in that cause for quite some time, which is unfortunate because I know he's so well beloved in many places.
Very good. Well, Michael, we're just about at the top of the hour. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. Again, we've been talking to Michael Heinlein, a regular contributor at our Sunday Visitor, available in a paper version. I'm sure you've seen the Our Sunday Visitor publications in your parishes. And also, you can catch all of his work online at osv.com. And now we'll look forward to reading your story in February, Michael, about these other four folks as we approach Black History Month. So I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us. I'm sure we've all learned a great deal as a result of that. So thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you. I'm very honored to be here and happy to be back anytime.
Very good. Thank you, Michael.
All right. Thanks so much. God bless you and all your listeners.
Thank you. God bless.
Bye now.
Bye-bye now. So I want to thank Michael for being with us. It's kind of a nice add-on to the Saints and Sinners Hour, which we had before. Hopefully you've learned a little bit about how the process works. And, I ask you to continue to pray for the cause for Matt Talbot's canonization, one that, as I mentioned, I've been involved with now for a few years, along with Father Doug McKay. We hope one day that St. Gabriel's Parish in South Philadelphia will become a shrine for Matt Talbot. We've joked in the past that when Father Lawless, the vice postulator for Matt's cause, was here back in 2014, that he actually made the proclamation that St. Gabriel's would be the national shrine to Matt Talbot. And it's not as simple as that. A number of steps, just like the canonization process, there's a number of steps that need to be done in order to actually have a shrine for someone, including him getting canonized first, I think. But anyway, it's been my pleasure to be with you for these last 2 hours. Sometimes I think I learn as much as hopefully you do. We try to impart that information and bring you guests that are current and important in the church. And as always, if you're away from the church, we need you back. Everybody's got a role to play. We've heard about four saints today and the roles that they've played. And if you're not with us, you're not against us, but the talents and things that you have to offer are missing from us. As Michael was saying, Catholic does mean universal. I often say everybody in the world's Catholic, just a lot of people don't know it yet. But if you're away from the church, come on back. Maybe this weekend is your time. And, get in touch with a local priest, local parish, and make arrangements to be reintroduced. So, again, it's been my pleasure to be with you for these past 2 hours. I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Until then, I hope God will hold you in the palm of his hand. And don't forget, come on out to inhissign.com and check out the website. Trying to do a better job of getting the shows you may have missed up on those podcasts. We're all caught up on Brian Gale's show from Monday, our recourse. And we should have the rest of the shows up at least for the month of January by the end of the week. So again, thank you again. We can't thank you enough for all of your continued support, especially your prayers that help us to keep these shows on the air. So until we meet again next week, take care and God bless.